Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema and of the clunking around.
Well, here's what's going on. The ceiling fan is on.
Yes.
The windows are open. Mm-hmm. Sliding door is open. Mm-hmm. The front door is open.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tearing apart a baguette.
Yes.
Because dinner.
Right.
It's going to go into the oven with the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Cotti is rummaging through a box of crackers and eating cheese.
Yes.
At this table.
Yes.
So there's a lot of little noises
little
going
shaking,
around.
Shaking mics around.
That's the ambience that you're going to enjoy during this podcast. Whatever.
Welcome.
Yes. Welcome.
You're Dave White.
Yes.
I'm Alonzo Duralde.
Yes. We're both film critics.
We are.
You write for The Wrap. I write for The Wrap.
It's
but
true.
You're like the boss of writing for The Wrap.
Because
you're the film reviews editor on top of being a critic.
That is true.
Also, you are on the Who Shot You podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. Also, you are on What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. You get around. Guess what else you're doing this month?
We can finally talk about it.
Say it.
Okay. So, remember last year we went to Atlanta and I did like introductions for 13 LGBT films that they screened in... starting in June for Pride Month. Well, I done did some stuff again for the film struck.
That's
so
good.
I'm part of a documentary that's up now called Dressing the Part, The Art of Drag in Film. And then in 2 weeks...
And it's fine.
And then on June 15th, you can hear me introducing... and hear and see me introducing... just about every feature film that Derek Jarman ever made, they
pretty
are
much,
screening
yeah.
On Filmstruck as well. So very excited about that. That was
explain
a,
Derek Jarman. To
Derek
the people who
Jarman
don't know.
Is a important figure in queer cinema. He was queer cinema when there was no such thing, and he started out as a painter. His first gig in film after making a lot of shorts, sort of, you know, Warhol style. He was the art director on Ken Russell's still controversial The Devils, and from there went on to make features like Sebastian, which was a gay erotic biopic of Saint Sebastian that was written entirely in Latin. Edward II, which was sort of a queer spin on the Christopher Marlowe play with heavy dollops of Outrage, the British activist group that was sort of like their ACT UP. Caravaggio and...
The Tempest.
The Tempest.
The Last of England.
Yes.
Wittgenstein.
A whole bunch of different
Blue.
Films. He's an extraordinary filmmaker. They're also showing Isaac Julian's documentary, Derek, which is a lengthy interview with Jarman interspersed with remembrances from Tilda Swinton, who was his muse.
This man gave you dummies Tilda Swinton.
That's right. Yeah. Every time you enjoy Tilda Swinton, you better thank Derek Jarman, because he's the one who brought her to prominence, and they worked together throughout his life and career, and he's...
I mean, if she hadn't been Tilda Swinton, she wouldn't have become prominent.
Well, of course.
With or without him.
Yes, and I'm sure,
however,
you know, without him, she would have figured out some other
the
way.
The marriage of her Swintonianism and his avant-garde queer weirdness.
Yes.
They were like a Reese's peanut butter cup.
So, like, you know, Edward II, when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in the early 90s, was sort of considered part of the new queer cinema movement. But while all the other people, you know, who were premiering films around that time were making their first or second feature film, like Gus Van Sant, Todd Haynes, those folks, Jarman had been making movies since the 70s. And
right.
He died of AIDS complications. But even after losing his eyesight, he made the film Blue, which is basically a blue screen with a richly textured soundtrack that
yes.
includes Swinton and other actors, and music by his longtime collaborator Simon Fisher-Turner.
Yep.
Anyway, so tons of Derek Jarman stuff coming up on Filmstruck. If you don't have Filmstruck, you might think about getting it. There's like a 14-day free trial, and watch me talk about things.
Do it. I got no time for a gentle pitch.
Tell him I sent you.
Yeah. Linoleum knife brought you there.
That's right.
And you tell those Filmstruck people, hey, why don't you have more Alonzo Duralde all the time?
No, don't. You don't have to do that.
I mean, don't bully them.
No.
It's Pride Month, after all.
Yes.
We're anti-bullying.
But, you know.
I mean, most of the time.
Well, unless we're doing it, but, you know. So this was the weekend where everybody got out of the way of the box office juggernaut of Solo. Oops.
Everything that came out this week was designed not to get in the way.
Yeah. Sort of counter-programming or, you know.
Counter-programming or films that were being dumped by their studios. And that would appear to be two of them, at least.
Well, I know one of them. I see what the other one
is. I don't know that. I mean, they had a press screening for Adrift, but not a lot of...
Not a lot of hoopla.
Not a lot of talk about it before it showed up. Like they didn't. They seemed to barely care.
Yeah, they totally dumped Action Point.
Action Point is an absolute dump.
Yeah.
Of a
release.
Yeah. Not a dump of a movie.
No,
but it's okay.
The studio was clearly not interested in anyone knowing that it existed.
No. Did you guys know that Action Point was opening this week? From the people brought you Jackass, starring Johnny Knoxville, and a lot of.
People Chris Pontius.
Punching him in the balls. Like, it's it's that movie.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to go?
Ow, my balls.
Yeah. So, why don't we just start talking about those movies?
Sure.
Because...
Well, we didn't see Adrift, so...
We're gonna slam through this hour...
Yeah.
...today, because we're in a hurry to get off and do other things.
Yes.
Such as chicken.
Right.
Yeah.
The meal making. Action Point opened this weekend, and it is an attempt to work the Jackass sort of ethos into a story. I mean, even with Bad Grandpa, there were sequences where, there was ostensibly a plot going on, but Knoxville was doing stuff in heavy makeup, and people didn't necessarily know they were in a movie or know what movie they were in or whatever. This movie is purely a narrative. There's no sort of hidden camera thing happening at all. And it is loosely based on this infamous theme park from New Jersey.
Called Action Park,
yeah. Where apparently the rides were incredibly dangerous.
Right. They were designed to be extra fast, extra rough.
Yeah.
And it existed in the 80s into, I think, the 90s.
Yeah,
and
open in the late 70s.
If you go to YouTube, you'll see ads that they made, local television ads for the place. And in this film, during the course of the story, the people who make, the people behind Action Point make a couple TV spots
that wind up looking exactly
pretty much looking exactly like the spots you will see on YouTube for the real place.
Yeah. So we begin in the present. Johnny Knoxville, again in the old age makeup that he had in Bad Grandpa, is babysitting his granddaughter and starts regaling her with the stories of when her mother was a child and would spend the summer with him when he ran this theme park called, Action Point. And, there was a time in this country where the nation was dotted with these little janky, dangerous, flea bag entertainment.
Or they weren't dangerous at all. Like, when I was a child, and I think this place still exists, when I was a little kid in New Hampshire, there was a little amusement park not far from our town in another town called Canobie Lake Amusement Park. Mm. And it was a thrill to get to go there when I was a little kid.
Well,
I think it still exists, but, it's not much of anything.
I was thinking about, I think it's called Pirate's World, which is the theme park that pops up in Santa Meets the Ice Cream Bunny.
Oh, yeah.
Which was one of many parks in Florida that got put out of business by Disney.
Right.
And so I'm sure there were a lot of regional parks that before Disney and Six Flags sort of got a stranglehold on just about everywhere in this country.
Right.
That existed to varying degrees of quality and success or whatever. This movie has a nostalgia for this notion of the 70s as the last great pre-lawsuit, pre-helicopter mom era.
Yeah, and they're fairly explicit about stating that.
Yeah, you know, where, and we grew up in the 70s, so we lived that, you know, the sort of unsupervised, dangerous playground equipment on asphalt era. Right. And, you know, I mean, yes, on the one hand, we never had play dates. There's a lot of, you just ran outside. Exactly. There's a lot of things from our childhood that we tend to sort of over-romanticize based on how monitored kids are today. But
I think there is a tendency with every generation of adults to, rather than praise the present for new developments in, you know, technology or safety procedures or something like that, rather than to celebrate that, we tend to look at it like we were the tough generation,
right?
And you kids today, you know, coddled in your little safety spaces or whatever. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly. And it's not like we grew up in the Depression. We just grew up in an era where, like, you know, where the creepy crawler maker was a hot piece of metal. And, you know, what was
it? It was a toy that you had to plug in, and it was like, it would burn your hand off a lot.
Yeah. Well, there was a sketch about this on Mystery Science Theater. We had wood-burning kits,
You know, and so there is this, the film does traffic in a bit of
gauzy nostalgia,
generational attitudinal
amnesia,
stupidity, really, because the 70s weren't so great, the 60s weren't so great, the 80s weren't so great, and
especially if you weren't a white man.
If
you know,
people are safer now because of regulations, then that's good. I believe, frankly, that one of the reasons that this film was buried, and this is pure conjecture on my part, is that Paramount probably didn't want a lot of hassle from people who would bring up the pesky fact that the original place,
real life action park,
was the location of six deaths.
Yes,
six people died at that place over the course of its time, you know, in operation. Nobody dies at this place in the movie. And everyone had a great time and set things on fire and smashed everything to pieces. And everyone got a concussion and they just bounced right back up. And that was great.
Kids drink beer.
And the children are drinking beer. Yeah. So, like, to bring the Jackass aesthetic to a narrative feature is funny. But I think there's a way to do it without being absolutely disingenuous about the danger, the real danger involved in what you are sort of lovingly conveying.
Yeah.
You know, this is definitely an affectionate film about Action Park, a place where six people were killed.
Yes. That said,
yeah,
this is a fairly entertaining movie if you like Johnny Knoxville's Jackass.
Getting to the quality of the film, if you like Jackass, you're going to like this movie more or less.
If you like watching Johnny Knoxville fall off things or having things lobbed at him.
And I absolutely do.
You know, and hearing him like sort of go, and then giggle about it. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm still in for this.
I am also still in for the brazen weirdness of Chris Pontius.
Yes.
A man who seems to be even less developed in a maturity sense than Knoxville. Like, the other guys from Jackass all said, you know what, we're gonna sit this one out.
Right.
And then of course Ryan Dunn is no longer with us.
Yes.
But Pontius was like, oh yeah, you want me to shake my wiener around in this movie again? Okay, yeah, I will. I'll do that.
He doesn't do that.
I'll do anything.
But he parades around in Speedos.
Did you look at how the Speedos were fitting him?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fine. Okay, no, he's not frontally nude.
Yes.
But come on.
He would have been if they'd asked.
If they'd said, you're going to be frontally nude, he would have been like, oh, okay. He would have been.
Yeah, you know, this isn't great, but I enjoyed myself.
It is completely adequate.
Yeah.
It is a
It's that rare out of the gate problematic fave.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
We don't need the passage of time to already raise an eyebrow at this thing.
You if you love these guys, you will think this is the worst one that you've seen of the entire bunch.
Yes.
But you know.
Still okay.
It's still okay.
Yeah.
In terms of, are injuries funny in movies, in comedy films? Yes, they are.
Absolutely.
I want to say that I might have liked this even more than Bad Grandpa because...
I barely remember Bad Grandpa.
Bad Grandpa had a lot more sentimentality than this.
Hmm.
This has a kind of rosy nostalgia that is actually very misplaced. But it doesn't have any sentimental stuff going on.
There's a stab at, like, his character...
Please be a better father
being
to your
a
daughter.
Better dad, yeah, but they, like, zip past that as fast as they can. So.
But Bad Grandpa, I really felt like was going for it. Like,
really milking
it. We want to move you.
Yeah.
And this one didn't. This one was like, we want to just, like... Make fart noises and fall down and...
Crash into things.
Right. I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
It was fine.
It was fine.
Yeah. We did not see Adrift.
No.
What do you hear? Do you hear anything good or bad about it?
Robert was kind of mezzo-mezzo to positive in his review on The Wrap. And then Christy and Matt on What the Flick rather liked it, actually.
All right.
Matt even liked it better than All Is Lost, but I think mainly because it was... Because there was more than one character and they talked about things.
Right.
Whereas I love, one of the things I love about All Is Lost is the silence of it all.
You saw American Animals.
Yes.
I did not.
So
what is that?
This is, it is a, based on a true story film where the real people involved are actually in the movie.
Okay.
Giving interviews to camera and the movie sort of cuts between them and the actors who are playing them.
All right.
And it's about a quartet of college guys who decide to...
A barbershop quartet?
No. Four dudes who plan a heist of rare art books at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky, which is an actual place. I did not know this.
Okay.
Like a first edition Darwin and, you know, like the Birds of America with paintings by Audubon and stuff. And it's Barry Keoghan from Killing of a Sacred Deer and Evan Peters from American Horror Story and X-Men Days of Future Past. And Blake Jenner from Everybody Wants Some. And I forget the fourth guy's name, but he's really good. And so it's about these guys who basically all they know is what they've learned from heist movies.
Right.
And the film is kind of... telling their story in the style of a heist movie while at the same time commenting upon the fact that they're not really the people who know how to do a heist. So you see them watching the killing. You see them giving themselves the code names from Reservoir Dogs and stuff. To which one character says, don't they all die at the end of that movie? And that level of self-awareness... could be unbearable.
Right.
But this movie has real energy to it and a real sense of humor and kind of a zip to it. And the fact that they will periodically keep cutting to the real guys sort of keeps it from feeling like just this sort of empty exercise in style. Like, this is a thing that actually happened. Here are the dudes who actually did it. Here's how they talk about it now and what they, you know, what was going through their mind as it was happening. And, you know, I think it's really well put together. The guy who directed it is named Bart Layton, and he did a documentary called The Imposter, which I haven't seen, but apparently also sort of jumps back and forth between kind of like fact and movie version of fact, you know?
Of it.
Yeah. Ann Dowd plays the librarian, so that's a plus.
Oh.
So yeah, it's a fun movie. It is. You know, ultimately kind of all gloss, but it's really good gloss, and it's really energetic gloss, and it's well acted. So, yeah, it's worth a look. I think you would like it.
Perhaps. You know I'm very busy.
You're so busy. I do know that.
So busy, I had a double time. and multitask by tearing up a baguette for this roasted chicken while doing a podcast.
It's amazing.
That's how packed my schedule is.
Yes. And now you're knitting with your feet.
I saw Upgrade.
Okay, which people seem to be surprised that it's better than they thought it was going to be.
They risk overpraising it.
Okay.
Because what's cool about it is very cool. And what's run-of-the-mill about it is pretty run-of-the-mill.
Well, I did see one person say the best way to watch it would be if they put it out on VHS and you made a copy of that VHS and watched that generation of it.
They are referring to the fact that it is a direct descendant of the Ozploitation genre mm-hmm. that took place in Australia right around the time of the Australian New Wave.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, they really talk a lot about. Yeah, while you know, Gillian Armstrong and Bruce Beresford and you know, these other, the Australian New Wave was becoming becoming famous on the local, on the international stage. You also had, like, the guy who directed Stone and Stunt Rock, you know.
Right.
I forget his name, but, like, becoming a big thing.
So, you know, this is an Australian film, mm-hmm. an Australian production. And it is from Lee Whannell, who created Saw and Insidious.
Yeah.
Now, this is a man who not only is clearly the descendant of all that Ozploitation stuff, but as a director, he is a man who never met an impossible physical situation that he didn't want to stick a character in and torture the person to death. I mean, he did, after all, create Saw.
Right.
Which, if you're going to distill it into a one-sentence thing, it's like, hey, I know you're chained to a machine that's going to pulverize your entire body. There's a key to the lock to that chain, and I have surgically embedded it behind your eyeball. Here's a spork.
Good luck.
You have to gouge your own eye out to get the key to unlock the thing to avoid your body from being pulverized. You have 10 minutes.
Oh, what was that?
What did I just do? I just somehow managed
your phone and some
throw
things.
My phone across the room without even trying. Like, I hit the cord that it was charging on, and the phone just flew. We're not going to edit this out.
Nope.
What was I talking about? Oh, Saw.
Sports.
Okay, so this is the story of a man, played by Logan Marshall Green,
A.K.A.
not Tom Hardy.
Yes.
And he's a real blue-collar Joe. He's a mechanic mm-hmm. of vintage automobiles. It is set in the near future. And his client is a young billionaire, weirdo, reclusive twink. It's also the inventor of an artificial intelligence thing that looks like a little cockroach.
Okay.
So, dude, Logan Marshall Green brings his wife to this meeting because she works in the tech industry. Mm-hmm. And she's like, we're developing artificial intelligence, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, don't even worry about what you do because I've got this thing
right.
that's going to revolutionize everything. And it's going to make your work irrelevant. And she's like, you know.
The cockroach is going to change everything.
On the way home from this encounter, they have a car accident. And after the car accident, they are descended upon by masked bad people who murder her and leave Logan Marshall Green paralyzed. And he's a quadriplegic. So, you know, Creeper comes along and says, guess what? If I put the cockroach into your body, you'll get to be like the $6 Million Man. You'll be able to walk again. You'll be faster and stronger and all that stuff. And so, you know, they do the operation, and Logan Marshall Green immediately goes around performing robotic martial arts moves on bad guys and murdering them in spectacularly gruesome and entertaining ways.
On his bad guys or just bad guys in general?
Bad guys in general, but he's on the hunt for the real bad guys who killed his wife.
Gotcha.
So, that's the movie. What I like about it...
And Betty, what's her face from Get Out, is in it?
Betty Gabriel plays the suspicious detective.
Yes.
She was the lady in Get Out who says, no, 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 no. But she's very straight-faced.
Right.
The main supporting character, really, in the film. She's the detective who's like, hey, how is it that every time there's a gruesome murder in a skanky part of town, the drone surveillance cameras pick up your wheelchair? And he's like, just a coincidence, I guess.
Lieutenant Columbo.
And so the film thinks it has something on its mind. You know, it thinks it's a commentary on tech anxiety and artificial intelligence and what could go wrong and blah, blah, blah.
The ethics of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the ethics of something. Gaming journalism. Yes. And why, look, it's Pilar. It's a jamboree in this apartment. Woo! Right now. Friend Gary Cotti is here. Niece Pilar just walked in.
Hello.
Everything's happening. We are, don't close that. The oven's on. It's
no, open
yeah,
the door.
Open that up. Yeah, thank you. Oven's on.
Thank
it's too
you.
Warm in here. We're late podcasting. Dinner's going to be a little late.
Everything's ruined.
We're never eating dinner. All right. Let's go back to this film review.
Okay, so presumably it's about things, but it's not really about anything.
It says it's about things. It's not about things at all. What it is about is fun killings and production design, because it all kind of looks and feels like a David Cronenberg-directed Flashdance sort of film. Like, the fun ambient lights, you know, very cool, moody tech environment.
Okay.
People's bodies have tons of portals that make them part machine, which is a super Cronenberg thing. I had a really good time.
So it's like a solid B movie.
It is a solid science fiction B movie. It would be the first film at the drive-in. Mm-hmm. And Action Point would be the second film at the drive-in. In fact, if you live near a real operational drive-in theater...
If Action Point is showing there,
we
or
do.
Upgrade...
If Upgrade and Action Point are the double feature, you should totally go. You'll have a wonderful time not caring about these films.
Now I want to know what's showing at our drive-in. We haven't been in a while.
We haven't. It's summertime, too. And it's almost,
right. It's time.
Almost time to start thinking about going. And we both watched The Gospel According to Andre.
Yes.
Which is the documentary about Andre Leon Talley. Shall I explain
you should
to
do
the
that.
Audience
you should
who
do that.
Is Andre Leon Talley? If you don't know...
Oh, Action Point is at the drive-in with A Quiet Place, an Upgrade with Breaking In. Maybe eventually, though, they'll share a bill. That would be perfect.
Upgrade and Breaking In is also a good double bill.
Mm.
A Quiet Place is a movie that also thinks it's about something. And
maybe isn't.
Might be too... certainly, I think A Quiet Place should be seen in a real movie theater.
Oh, well, yeah.
With people who are behaving themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Drive-in's a little too rowdy for A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine watching Solo at the drive-in and not being able to see anything on the screen? You know, I read an article this week about the cinematography of Solo and how Bradford Young was absolutely intentionally shooting for low light.
Uh-huh.
However... Apparently, just like me, people across the nation are complaining to their theater operators that they can't see anything on screen,
well,
and this is the fault of the exhibitors.
But here's
is the fault of the movie theaters that will not light their screens properly.
That is an ongoing concern, and I agree that it's important. But again, as I pointed out, I went to the premiere. I went to the screening that if any other screening had like 10,000 people from Disney calibrating and figuring out that it had to look exactly just so.
Yeah.
Like, I saw it under the ideal circumstances, and it still looked like a mud bath.
All right. Okay. All I'm saying is I'm going to give it a half a benefit of the doubt Because I saw it at the Grove.
Right.
And the Grove simply does not care.
Oh, no, absolutely
they
not.
They just do not care.
You know what? Maybe, like, when they, if they have, I mean, who knows? Maybe since it's tanking, maybe they won't. But if they have, like, you know, award season screenings
Academy
of it.
Screenings
and
of
they
it.
Show it at, like, the Academy or somewhere really nice.
I bet you they do. I bet you they show this at awards time because they want technical.
All right, well, so maybe we'll see it again, and maybe
no, it's boring.
Well, I know I don't want to see it again, but I wouldn't mind looking at it if I didn't look at it the right way.
No. Here's what'll happen: we'll get sent a Blu-ray eventually.
All right,
and we'll look at it and see what it's supposed to look like in its purely digital state.
Right.
I am not sitting through that.
Well, it's purely digital, the theater too.
Yeah, but not. But our TV screen is not going to be the problem.
Right.
The movie screen in the theater might actually be the problem.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, explain
it's
Andre...
It's still boring as hell, you guys.
It is.
It is not a good movie.
Andre Leon Talley, please.
Andre Leon Talley still is, he's alive. He was a fashion journalist from the 70s until today. He's in his late 60s now, but when he started, he was a very young man. And there's no one else like him. He came up in a time right as the civil rights movement was taking shape.
He grew up in the Jim Crow South.
Tall, black, and gay.
Yeah.
And from an early age was raised by his grandmother to, you know, dress well, clean your room, sit up straight, study, do your homework.
Yes.
Like that kind of life. Go to church, behave yourself. So he did. And he was obsessed with fashion at a young age.
Yeah.
Obsessed with, I've read his memoir as well. And in the memoir, he talks about, you know, just going into his grandmother's bedroom and like just touching the gloves and being like, how beautiful these gloves are, studying the material and learning about fabrics and stuff like that. He went to school at Brown.
Reading Vogue in the high school library.
Reading Vogue in the high school library. He went to Brown. He got a master's degree in French studies. He learned how to speak French. He knew where he was going. And he studied and did all the homework that you are supposed to do where you go out and do a gig like that.
Yeah.
So he came to the world of fashion journalism already armed with a deep knowledge of
art history,
fashion history,
design,
everything you could know.
And fluent in
French.
And
he has spent his life still learning. In this documentary, Anna Wintour talks about how she felt it was a good strategy to hire him. And here's a quote. My own fashion history wasn't quite what it should have been, but I knew his was.
Yeah.
So she completely took him and, you know, bolstered her own life with his knowledge.
Yeah, because he'll make references to, like, Regency or Beau Brummel or, you know, the 1947 Dior New Look skirts or whatever.
You know,
like
17th century Austrian countesses and
yes.
things, people like that. People
Lady
that nobody knows.
Lady Ottoline Morel.
Yeah.
You know.
So he gets to New York. He goes to a letter of introduction to Deanna Vreeland, the legendary editor of Vogue. Now, in his memoir, he talks about being kind of tongue-tied. And she was not having it. She was like, speak up! You know. And,
but she became his mentor.
But she immediately became his mentor. And he was by her side until her death.
Yeah.
And think about that. Think about walking into the room, showing Deanna Vreeland the project that you just worked on,
mm-hmm.
and her saying, you, I pick you, you're now my protege, we're going to be together for 20 years. welcome to everything.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what she did.
Yeah.
He went off to Paris. There's this great footage of him being, you know, young and in Paris and at these early shows, like Azzedine Elias shows in an apartment. And
okay, now they show him and young Karl Lagerfeld.
And they were friends.
Palling around, and you were like, well, that ended, and the movie doesn't talk about this.
The movie does not talk about it.
So what happened?
I don't know.
Is it in the book?
Nope. He does mention it, though, on his recent visit to the Wendy Williams set.
Aha.
He was on her show
last
week.
Where all tea is spilled.
That's where the tea gets poured, yeah. But not all of it, because he, she brings him, she brought up Karl Lagerfeld, and he said, well, he's a sometimes fair weather friend. Which means, you know, we're not speaking. I guarantee you that's what that means. No, so I don't know what happened, but I know that they're not as tight as they used to be, based on his, you know, thing.
Interesting.
He also talked about something very different on Wendy Williams than he talks about in the film. In the film, he discusses having no love life whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
He also says that he had lovers, but no one who loved him.
Hmm.
But on Wendy Williams, he basically says the same thing. And she wants to dig in and find out who. And he says, I'm not going to name names, but the most outrageous was the one who slept in her pearls. And she was like, her? And he says, he goes, darling, my sexuality is fluid. I love that. I love a bisexual Andre Leon Talley.
Why not?
Just getting it whenever. But he actually says in the film, he was accused of sleeping with lots of designers.
Yes, and with Mrs. Vreeland.
And with Mrs. Vreeland. And he says, it's rude, it's dirty.
And it's racist.
And it's racist, and it never happened.
Yeah. Now, this movie, for one thing, it fits into a couple of categories of a lot of recent documentaries.
Right.
One, they managed to drag in the election of Donald Trump, which I'm not entirely sure that it was super relevant, but I mean, I guess it's a thing that happened while they were making it, and so there it is.
I think I understand why the election was in the film.
Mm-hmm.
If people are going to criticize Andre Leon Talley, and they do, because, you know, he's on Twitter, so you're fair game. They often criticize him for being apolitical.
Hmm.
He's not apolitical. His framework for seeing the world is fashion.
Right.
And he even says things like, it's a moral code to dress well.
Yes.
Things like, I only eat caviar when I'm at Valentino's house. So don't put me up on a pedestal.
Right.
Because the only time I eat caviar is at Valentino's home. Yeah. He understands the world through fashion, which is always, just like every other art, political. Fashion is political, film is political, music is political, television is political.
But there's a tendency to think that people who are experts in the world of luxury and expensive stuff, that they are oblivious to the realities of society.
And he even says, one of the things in the film that made me understand why they put the Trump election in the film is he covered the fashions of the inauguration. And he praised Melania Trump's outfit on Inauguration Day. Rightly so. That outfit was impeccable. She looked amazing. And he even says, I'm not going to talk about her husband, and I like this outfit on her today. And that's it. He was doing his job that day.
The other thing is, I mean, there have been a lot of fashion docs over the last year.
Yeah, there have been.
I mean, Valentino and the
Manolo Blahnik,
Rafe Simon, the Deanna Vreeland, the Eye Has to Travel, the September issue, you know. So I mean, like, that's been a thing. But I think there's also, and no one's really talking about this, but there has been a strain of documentary in the last few years that I think is sort of like a hopped up magazine profile.
Kind of, yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of interest in really, like, getting too deep or too negative.
That is correct.
Or too provocative.
And this is different from those.
Somewhat. But I think in general, these kind of documentaries They are granted access, whether they were friends with the subject beforehand or, you know, are obviously making the film very much with the subject's, you know, auspices and agreement to do so. And, you know, they talk to every famous person they can to get, like, secondary quotes from, usually gushing about the subject. And I'm not saying that every documentary has to be an expose, but there is a certain, you kind of know the beats. Like, it's about the hardscrabble childhood and about the this triumph and that triumph and this setback and then this triumph. And, you know, I don't know. I sort of feel like a lot of these movies start feeling really samey, and they're only interesting in as much as their subject is interesting. You know, like, I look at a film like, did you ever watch that documentary, Who is Henry Jaglom?
No.
Here's why you should.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is one of the only documentaries I've ever seen about a living filmmaker.
Where people talk
yeah. trash about him
right.
and talk
right.
about him being a terrible person to work with and being bad with actors and all this kind of
right.
stuff. While also talking to people who love him and say that he's great and he's wonderful with actors. You know, and I think so many of these documentaries now, and like HBO does them and CNN does them, and they're basically magazine articles.
The Yves Saint Laurent documentary, I've seen, have there been like four of them?
Yeah, I was going to say.
I've seen, they're not all hagiographic.
Okay. Well, at least one of them was posthumous, right?
Yes. And this one, I'm going to argue with you about it, because I believe that even though everyone has nothing but praise for him,
mm-hmm.
I think it's warranted. Because is he probably difficult to some people? Yeah. Has he burned bridges somewhere along the line? Yeah. Did those people get interviewed? Nope.
I'm not...
However,
okay.
What he is a groundbreaking individual.
Unquestionably.
Represents something that the world didn't think it wanted or needed, and he said, well, I'm here, and I'm going to do this, out of my way, please.
Right, and again, I'm not trying to put this particular movie on blast. I think there are a lot of, like RBG, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, I would say pretty much the same thing. What's most interesting about the movie is that her life is interesting and that she's an interesting subject, and, you know, and again, what is formally interesting about this film is him. You know, these movies kind of feel like longer, somewhat more expensive 60-minute segments.
Basically. I understand that.
And so this is another one of those movies. I'm not saying that it's any worse or that it's more flagrant.
There is nothing inventive about this film.
Yeah. But he is fascinating, and he makes it worth seeing.
He is an important cultural figure.
Unquestionably. And I'm saying people should see this film because people should know more.
He is a queer revolutionary.
Yes.
And he is becaped every day of his life.
And also the fact that, I mean, obviously, when he started, he was skinny. And he worked his way into that world when he was skinny.
Yep.
But he is the only fat man in the world of fashion, pretty much.
Costello Tagliapietro.
Okay, I mean in terms of somebody who does not actually create fashion.
Like okay.
Somebody who covers fashion, somebody who is... you know, a cognoscenti who gets to run with that crowd.
And so what's your point?
Because when I watch fashion documentaries, as much as everybody talks about how, like, oh, it's this great art, and oh, it's so universal, and oh, people love fashion magazines because they're so happy and they're such a great fantasy, blah, 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 part of me can't stop thinking about the fact that fashion exists to make skinny people look great. That fashion does not care about fat people, and fashion does not want fat people to wear them. You know, the reason that we...
I think you are kind of right and kind of wrong.
You know,
continue.
The reason that we have to order everything online because stores don't want to carry our size. And that,
and thank God for Costello Tagliapietro for
yes,
that. Yes,
absolutely.
Because they have our size.
I love their two.
You got a closet full of their shirts now.
Their stuff is great. JCRT. Check it out, people. Beautiful, beautiful plaids. But they are the exception and not the rule.
Right.
Tom Ford never wants to see us wear a thing that he ever makes.
All right.
Neither does Karl Lagerfeld.
Okay, you've derailed the conversation.
No, but,
now
but what I'm talking
about your own, you know, grumpiness about
no,
fat people.
Okay, no, I a point that I am trying to make here, which is that he is. While the movie talks a lot about the fact that his experience as a black man is unique in the world of high fashion.
Yes.
without ever really discussing it, showing him as this large figure in a caftan who still hobnobs with, you know, all the designers and who, you know, is a major force in the world of fashion,
mm-hmm.
I find that kind of fascinating to look at because okay. I think that fashion is a fat-phobic world.
It often can be. I agree with you.
Thank you.
But that's not what this film is about.
No, of course it's not what it's about. Okay. It's about him. But part of what him is, I mean, they do talk about his weight. They show him at, like, the Duke facility
weight.
And stuff.
Yes.
And you know, he talks about, you know, when he blew up.
He does talk about that as well.
Yeah.
No, I know. It's part of his life.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, it's like, what I really feel is important about this movie is the things he says.
No,
those really grand
pronouncements. Yes.
Like, from the moment he was in the September issue, yelling, "There is a famine of beauty," and Vera Wang raising her hand up, like, "Say it,
testify."
Preach it. Yeah. And in this one, I just wrote down the things that he said. He's like, "You need to have a moment every day, whatever it is."
I like the
have
woman,
a moment.
The college friend who said that when they first met, he said, "How many pieces of Louis Vuitton luggage do you have?" And she said,
"She's like,
none."
He's like,
"You
need
will need
them.
It when you will make the crossing on the QE2.
I love that he calls back that quote from September issue by saying, "You need a diet of beauty." I think that's true.
Yes. And I think why I like him and a lot of fashion people drive me up the wall is that I think he is a genuine aesthete.
Yes, he is.
And I think that he would have been himself as a museum curator, as
right.
an art historian, as yep. any number of things. It just happened to be that fashion is the world where, you know, that he loves and that he's found a place for himself.
And one final thing that I feel is a really telling thing that he talks about as well. He, in spite of doing all the homework when he was young,
mm-hmm.
when he got to Paris, he said he was terrified.
Hmm.
He said all his luggage was mismatched, and he was terrified. And I think there is a value to feeling terrified.
Of course.
When you are...
trying something, doing something
new. Working on something new, like you're moving in the direction of doing the thing you really want to do.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was young and I went off to London and I went there alone for a semester of school and I didn't have anyone guiding me or, you know, showing me around or anything. And I was out of my mind with fear for the first week, thinking, I've made a huge mistake. I have to go home. I'm going to die in this place. I was that out of my comfort zone. But, you know, I just pushed on and got used to all the shock of everything being new around me.
Right.
And I learned what I was supposed to do. I learned what I was supposed to do with the school. And, you know, being as mundane a thing as becoming a middle school teacher in my first week of doing that.
If somebody like Andre Leon Talley can be nervous about something, then, you know.
Anybody can be.
Anyone is allowed.
Yeah. So there's like a blessing to terror. You take it and move through it. Obviously, do your homework before you get there.
Is that anything else?
That's it. Those are the movies.
All right. What's your DVD?
You should see this movie. I really liked it.
Yeah.
I think he is such a cool dude. I have admired him for a long time. I've read him for decades.
Yeah, if you only know him from, like, you know, America's Next Top Model,
right.
You're missing out.
Right. He's really something and someone you should learn about and read about.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that there isn't, and there might be, I just might be wrong. I'm surprised there isn't an anthology, a collection of things that he's written over the years.
Well, what was the thing that he was signing in the movie? The ALT 365?
Some big coffee table book. I don't know what that is.
I'm assuming that was being
written.
Check it out.
I'll look, find out what that is. But.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, I think, you know, He gives the idea of, and I don't want to say this word in a way that in any way diminishes his many skills, but he gives fandom a good name.
Right.
He gives enthusiasm about a thing and turning that enthusiasm into your career where you're writing about it and you're covering it and you're telling people about it. He gives that a good name.
He's very passionate about his work, and I really admire that as well.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like, you know, my job, learning about film, watching film, mm-hmm. studying film, is worth doing.
Yeah. Hmm. What's your DVD pick?
I will never have as many awesome capes.
You don't own a single cape.
As Andre, I don't own a single cape.
You're starting really late on that front.
Where will I get my cape?
It'll find you.
Thank you, Pilar.
For the third time, what is your DVD pick?
The whole town's talking.
Explain.
1936, John Ford, comedy. Mm. This is the first comedy I've seen in my roughly chronological self-education on John Ford's films. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this for a couple of years now, watching John Ford movies as they hit TCM or sometimes occasionally play repertory here in town.
He made 13,000 of them.
He made so many movies, it'll take me another 10 years to get through all of them. But I'm still in the 1930s, and I have it, and so many of his early films were lost.
Yeah.
Because they were silent, and no one took care of them, and the prints are gone. But, you know, so all through the late 20s, early 30s, the ones that are available to be seen, I'm still in the 1930s. And so this is a comedy starring Edward G. Robinson, who was a big star at the time. He's a Hollywood legend for playing
gangsters.
Gangsters. Short little, hey, kind of tough-talking, hey, kind of guy.
Little Caesar.
Yeah. And in this movie, he plays dual roles. He plays a gangster who's a killer, whose name is actually Killer. And he plays a mild-mannered clerk who is the identical doppelganger of the killer. And Gene Arthur is his co-worker. And she's this also tough-talking, really funny, just firecracker
dame.
Of a dame. And it's, he's secretly in love with her, and the killer finds him and, like, kind of holds him hostage and makes him go out at night as, makes him stay home while he goes out as the clerk. It's this mistaken identity thing and the comedy of errors, and it's really, really funny. It's available, I don't know, somewhere, DVD or whatever. I saw it on TCM.
Okay.
And it's really cool. You should watch this movie.
Mine is the September issue. There have been quite a few good docs. I do like the Rafe Simon one a lot. But September issue is about fashion, but it's also about journalism and, you know, what's left of print journalism. And it's about Anna Wintour putting together the 2009 September issue of Vogue. Save me some of that, will you?
Maybe.
And
we're eating Manchego cheese right now.
Yes. It's the movie, I think, that introduced the non-fashion world to the glory that is Grace Coddington.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a fun movie, and it kind of has a built-in ticking clock. And having worked at a magazine on a much smaller scale, obviously, but just the idea of all the little fires that pop up in the process of putting an issue together, and looking at the pages on the wall, and having to make these decisions and figure stuff out, it's an entertaining film. I liked it a lot. And as print media goes the way of the dodo, it's an important record that it was a thing that ever existed.
Once upon a time, there were magazines, you
exactly.
guys. I got some letters.
Okay.
This is from Renee. I just watched one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I was there with a group, so I couldn't walk out without being rude. As I was enduring this travesty, I could hear in my head the exasperated "ugh" sound that Alonzo sometimes makes when discussing terrible movies. I just thought I'd let you know.
I'm in your head.
In case you were wondering, the movie in question was an animated version of Cinderella that took place on a sci-fi boat in Naples Harbor. Avoid it like the plague. I don't even know what this is.
Maybe we'll never come to the United States.
Listen, dude, you want to see a travesty of animation? Romeo and Juliet.
I knew you were going to say this.
Colon,
sealed with a kiss.
Sealed with a kiss. An all-seal version of Romeo and Juliet.
Seal plays all the roles.
Cartoon talking seals, not the singer, play all the roles in this Romeo and Juliet movie.
And it has a happy ending.
Has a happy ending.
Spoiler.
It is an abomination.
And you saw
And I've seen
Delco.
Food Fight. And I've seen Delco. So just, as they say on Twitter, let that sink in.
I'm sold.
Angelique. Hello, Angelique. This letter is from February. Sorry for the long delay, Angelique.
Yes, yeah, somebody messaged on Facebook, like, did you lose my letter? Do I have to resend it? I was like, no, we got your letter.
Angelique says, first, right off the bat, I love you guys, I love you guys, I love you guys. Thank you, Angelique.
Thanks.
I have been a long-time What the Flick watcher.
Oh.
From the show's debut through multiple studios, pre-current, whoa, post-current. But after witnessing Mr. Dave White tap in on some episodes, I resolved to stop wembling and set aside... is wembling a word that I should know? It's
British slang, I don't know.
Okay. Set aside some serious podcast time. Now, with me spending a lot of bedtime recovering from surgery, isn't it great to be in bed when you recover from surgery and just you don't have to do anything? It's fantastic.
It's been a while for me, but yes.
It happened to me once, and I remember those days fondly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes. That magical catheter.
Yeah.
Guess who had to empty his bag, everybody?
That catheter was crazy. Remember when they took it out?
Oh, yeah. It was like watching a magician
like
pull handkerchiefs out of his sleeve. Yeah. It just kept going and going. I was like, oh, my God. Make it stop.
I watched the whole thing come out.
Yeesh.
Nuts. Yeah. Well, you know.
But we're not having scunji.
You grew up in a house of doctors. You don't care about that stuff.
You're right.
After recovering from surgery, I'm finally getting around to doing a blazing binge session of past LK podcasts.
Yeah.
Your chemistry is palpable and glorious. Well, it better be. We're married to each other. Alonzo of the Good Hair is a sorcerer supreme in all the vocal arts of shade and side-eye. And while this is just a mash note.
I know.
And while listening to his full-throated laugh, I've come to the stark realization, Dave is my manic pixie dream girl. I've been down with weaponized tea since watching A Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane as a child. So basically, don't change a thing. It would break my little heart. But seriously, thank you. I can't tell you how many fits of cackling you have gifted me with. Regards from a fangirl. Angelique, my mother watched too much Dark Shadows. St. Pierre. P.S. Mince pie is a huge thing in our household, and you are right. We don't understand why other people don't get it. Either way, we get all the pie.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a letter about how great we are. I don't mind those.
No?
I'm a little embarrassed when I read them, because I'm like, this is too much. Like, don't say too many nice things about me, because... That's not right.
I'm okay with it.
What else do we have to talk about?
I think we had another letter.
No, that's the letter.
Oh, okay.
Two letters. Oh, hey, my birthday is coming up this Thursday, June 7th. I'll be 54. And a listener, she knows who she is. She sent me a beautiful cookbook in the mail.
Ah, yes.
As a birthday gift. The Plenty More cookbook from Yotam Ottolenghi. So many vegetables. It's an all-vegetable cookbook. I can't wait to turn you into a vegan.
That's never happening.
It's never happening with me either, but this is going to push it
yeah.
to All the right. next level. These are fancy recipes, too. These are like 12 ingredients and it's all chopping. Like, it's going to take you an hour of chopping just to make these recipes. I'm so stoked.
All right.
Thank you, listener. You know who you are.
Yeah,
I know
right.
who you are. It's funny because it came from Amazon. And the only reason I say I know who this person is because this person never signs the notes.
Yes.
But when you go to Amazon to leave the automatic thank you note,
it tells you who it's sending it to.
It tells you the first name of the person, and I don't know if it's like a stock name that they just put in the thing. If so, it's a crazy coincidence that the stock name that they use on Amazon just happens to be the name of this person that I know sent this thing.
She sent me...
It's like this little game that we've been playing now for a few years where she sends us birthday gifts, and I'm like, I know who you are.
It's always from the listeners of Linoleum.
From the listeners of Linoleum Night, but I know which one you are.
Yes.
You're far too generous.
We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
She sent me a lovely book on the films of Todd Haynes.
Yes.
I look forward to reading this summer.
Yeah.
Hey, you should join our club. Not you, Dave, but you, the listener.
Yeah, sure, you should.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yeah.
We have extra content for you.
It's premium content.
We have LKTV, a podcast of television.
Quality premium content.
We have Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yeah.
We have Linoleum Nights, which is the one where we swear and talk about taboo subjects.
Right.
And there's neat prizes. There's shirts and tote bags and mugs and hangout opportunities.
Still
and
sending them out.
Yes, bless your heart.
But here's the good news. Everything's finally in.
Oh, good.
Like, it's been coming in dribs and drabs, all the restocks and stuff.
We have stacks of merch
as
everywhere.
As of Wednesday, when I got a new batch of enamel badges,
mm-hmm.
all the way from England, which is where they make them. Because Ed Luce, of Wovable Oaf fame, he did Wovable Oaf enamel badges. And I was like, where'd you get those done? He was like, this company in England called Made by Cooper. And I was like, all right, that's what I'm going to do. So they finally showed up. So now everything has finally been restocked.
Mm.
So if you've been waiting and waiting and waiting, I'm very sorry. Here it comes. Dribs and drabs have been going out. Believe me, I've been on the case.
But if you haven't joined yet and you haven't gotten it yet, make it happen.
You'll be at the end of the queue.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. But you'll immediately get content.
You
so
will
much
immediately
content.
Get premium quality content.
That's right. So yeah, check that out. And, like I said, check me out on Filmstruck this month and, go, you know, visit ChristineLear.com and listen to Bibbs and Whitney on Canceled Too
right.
Soon and Critically Acclaimed on the Schmoes No Network. And of course, check out the Schmoes, check out, Dennis Henning with Dennis Hensley and Sewers of Paris and All Things Cozy and the Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU. And Secretly Timid, thank you, Blue, for our theme music. He's at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at LinoleumCast. You can leave us a positive review when you're subscribing at Apple Podcasts. Make it 5 stars. And leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com, and Spotify and Google Play and Podbean and CastBox and iVooks and whatnot else. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. We're going to do an all letters episode at some point because
we have
a lot of mail.
Yeah, that's
going to
happen. I don't know when that's happening. It's
anyway.
Happening sometime soon.
All right. Anyway, y'all are great. We thank you for listening. We'll be back next time. So until then,
goodbye.